You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello, Heat Nation. I'm David Ramil, a credentialed reporter and the host of Locked On Heat, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Please make sure to subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts to get the latest episodes. The Heat were down by as many as 14, but just as they have throughout the playoffs, they stayed resilient, took the lead late in the game, but the Celtics forced overtime on a controversial foul call. Miami Heat were down one, took a shot, hit it, and collected the foul, put the Heat up one, and then Bam Adebayo with the biggest defensive play of his career, blocking a dunk attempt from Jason Tatum, sealing the victory. Tatum was actually able to get a three-point attempt off as time was waning down, but the shot rimmed out, and Miami collects a Game 1 victory in the Eastern Conference Finals of the Boston Celtics. And to help me break it all down, Keith Smith of Yahoo Sports, Real GM, Celtics blog, and lots of other places throughout the course of his career. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing well, man. Thanks for having me in here. I know we were talking before we get started. We're both completely exhausted, and all we did was watch.
That was an incredible game. I don't think I can possibly do it justice on this podcast because it feels like it was so back and forth. The game started off as badly as you could expect for Miami and probably as well as you might like for the Boston side of things. Jason Tatum was going off early. He looked like he was confident and aggressive in getting his shots, and Miami had no answer. They weren't rotating well on defense. They couldn't stop him. And then Marcus Smart was absolutely sensational. He just looked like he was on fire early on and late, to be honest with you. He finished with 26 points to contribute to Tatum's 30. That was, I think, the difference maker early in the first quarter. And again, what contributed to that early lead for Boston.
Yeah, definitely. Now, what you worry a little bit about if you watch the Celtics a lot is when Smart hits his first few, you know that there are several more going up right on the heels of it. And some of them are probably going to be a little bit questionable. But I thought he took a couple that were a little like, oh, goodness, including one where he missed Jaylen Brown wide open under the basket just to launch and transition. And but that's the give and take with Marcus Smart. You know, more often than not, he's going to come through with big plays. So you don't worry too much when he takes a handful of bad shots here and there.
Yeah, I saw some people mentioning this, and it makes sense that probably the best thing for Miami was that Smart falls in love with that shot early on after the first few fall. I don't think it really came back to bite the Celtics in the ass. No. If anything, I think, you know, again, he was their second best scorer. He was contributing defensively as he always does all night. Just a great game from the Celtics side of things. But on the Miami side, I think, again, they were down big early in the first quarter, and then the second quarter, they got Goran Dragic going early on. He was finding that mismatch against Kemba Walker, attacking it pretty regularly, finding some success, finished 11 of 19 from the floor for 29 points, a team-high 29 points. Also, 3 of 6 from the three-point range. So after struggling a little bit in the last few games against the Milwaukee series, Goran gets his mojo back against the Celtics, as we knew he would. That matchup against Kemba Walker, clearly Walker, not the best defensive player, a little undersized. So you knew that Goran was going to try to attack him regularly, as he has throughout his career, especially even in the 2016 playoffs when Kemba was with the Charlotte Hornets and Goran was able to win that matchup pretty handily. But I think, you know, we've seen Boston throughout the course of the season, and especially in the playoffs, they switch so effectively where they minimize what Walker's obvious weaknesses are on the defensive end. What was the difference maker, I think, as far as Goran being able to go off as well as he was in the second quarter?
Oddly enough, I think some of it had to do with Duncan Robinson getting in foul trouble in having to come out, and then Tyler Hero coming in for him. I think then it seemed pretty clear to me that Boston's plan was to maybe hide Walker on Duncan Robinson. And why I say hide is Robinson's just not going to beat him off the dribble. He's not going to take him down inside. You got to navigate the screens and the DHOs to stay attached to him. But Walker can generally do okay with those kind of things. And I think once Hero came in, that made it a little more – Hero, Dragic, it's kind of pick your poison, right? They're at this point, they're both good at attacking off the dribble. They're both going to do things in the screen game and that type of stuff. So I think that's what threw Boston off a little bit. As odd as it was, I think that almost kind of helped Miami get going because then Hero was able, he had a great game. I just missed a triple-double. You know, I thought he played great, but I thought, you know, then once Walker had to pick up Dragic, once Dragic got going downhill repeatedly, it was about four or five plays in a row where he broke down the defense and got in or around the paint, and either he scored or created a good look for somebody else. At that point, I was like, all right, now he's kind of unlocked. That's going to be a problem the rest of the way.
And in case anybody listening to the show didn't watch the game, Duncan Robinson picked up two fouls within the first few minutes of the game, and he got into early foul trouble, was taken out, and Tyler Hero immediately inserted into the game, wound up playing a team high. No, not team high. He played 40 minutes, so pretty surprising off the bench. But again, considering the fact that Duncan was in foul trouble, necessary for him to come in there, initiate a lot of the offense, get his shot going, was looking to make plays for everybody. And as Keith mentioned, one assist shy of a triple-double. So a phenomenal night for him. Finished with 12 points, 11 rebounds, and 9 assists. So something I've pointed out a lot lately, and it was probably pretty evident to you as well, Keith, maybe if you haven't been able to watch him as closely as we have, but his playmaking has really gone up, I think, a significant level. And one of the things that Eric Spoelstra was mentioning in his post-game press conference was that, you know, this is already a second season for him. And I hadn't thought about this, but he has been playing effectively for a full calendar year now, considering, you know, his rookie season began late last year. It's already been a full calendar year. I think he's taken advantage of the hiatus more than most players have because he was continuing to work. And while we consider him a rookie, in effect, he's probably more like a second-year player. He's had two training camps. He's already gone through this experience. And, of course, the bubble situation being as unique as it is, he's well prepared for it. His confidence is obviously there at a high level. And I think he just wants to take those big shots. He took them down to stretch today when Miami needed a bucket late in the game. He was there. He was competent. And he was a huge difference maker. And I'm going to go back to that Duncan Robinson point because I'm wondering if Brad Stevens – you were on the call with Stevens and the Celtics after the game, right?
Mm-hmm. I was.
Did Stevens mention anything about Robinson changing the game plan or that he got into foul trouble changing the game plan? Because they are clearly two different players. Robinson, not much of a playmaker, mostly a decoy on offense, you know, as he continues to go around those multiple screens. And even if you're going to have Walker chasing him or something like that in effect, it changes your defense considerably. So was there anything about that? Did anybody ask him whether or not Robinson's foul trouble might have impacted the way they played Miami defensively?
Nothing that specific, but what he did mention was he talked about losing containment on the ball handlers, and he specifically referenced Dragic, Butler, and Hero with that. And then the other thing he mentioned was how good Hero was in transition, that he had several good passes in transition, and then he obviously hit that huge three late in transition, which was a big, big shot in the game. So I think that's, you know, that's Brad Stevens' way of, without saying, he's never going to give you anything kind of strategically that he's looking at, but that's his way of kind of saying, like, yeah, those guys really hurt us, and that necessarily wasn't what we were expecting. What I want to say with Hero, too, is I will chime in on what you were kind of saying briefly here is, he to me was a guy who I thought was like, this guy's probably going to be a pretty good shooter off the bench as a rookie, but his playmaking now, he has really, you know, become the Heat's backup point guard because Kendrick Nunn, I know he played tonight, but I think that was probably mostly because of Robinson's foul trouble and Hero had to come in early. Yeah. I don't expect we're going to see much of Nunn because he was pretty awful in this game. So Hero's become the backup point guard, and you would normally think, all right, well, that's a good thing for you if you're going against him because, you know, we can get up in this kid. But he's tightened up his handle so much. He's such a good passer. He sees the floor really well. So now I'm now rethinking my kind of ceiling for him as a player where I'm like, all right, this guy's now a really great combo guard because he's still got really good size too for the position. What's he? He's about 6'4 or so, right?
No, he's more like, I think, 6'5, 6'6.
Is he? Okay. So even better, right? Then you really start to look at it and you start to think about, this guy is now, that's a whole level up from what I even thought he was going to be, and I already thought he was going to be pretty good.
Well, you know, the scouting report on him was that he was short-armed, and there's the J.J. Redick comparisons, I think, mostly because they're both white shooters.
Yeah.
But the reality is that, I mean, Hero has been a surprisingly good rebounder. Mm-hmm. Not defender. Defender, I think he still needs some work, but rebounding-wise.
Yeah, it's competitive, at least.
But, yes, and as far as the his knack for tracking the ball when it caroms off the rim has been very, very impressive. He's got great hops. He's got great agility. He just seems to be in the right place at the right time. So that's why he pulled down 11 boards and a huge game one in the Eastern Conference Finals. And you think about the fact that not only is this his first taste of the playoffs, they keep advancing, they keep going deeper in the playoffs. He doesn't seem to shy away from the moment. And to come up one assist shy of a triple-double just speaks incredible volumes of his confidence and his ability overall. But he was really the only bright spot for Miami as far as the bench is concerned. As you pointed out before, Kendrick Nunn getting 13 minutes of play, and while that might have been directly tied to Duncan's foul trouble, his minutes were not bad. He was a team worst plus minus minus 10. He only finished with 3 points, 1 of 5 shooting from the field. Just looked lost on defense. His shot wasn't falling. And as I've mentioned a ton of times, if his offense isn't going, then there's not much point in playing him. And now there had been minutes against Milwaukee where you saw a better version, a more effective version of Nunn, particularly as a playmaker and defender. That wasn't the case against the Celtics. I mean, your eyes must have lit up when you saw Nunn struggling out there. And I imagine guys like Brad Wanamaker, who finished with 11 points and looked really effective, he must have been ecstatic to be going up against Kendrick Nunn.
Yeah, I think Wanamaker and then I think Walker had a chance to get going against him a little bit in the brief second half appearance that he made. So yeah, I think that's a guy that they feel – hey, we can get this guy. You're absolutely right. He reminds me of one of those guys. If he misses his first couple shots, his head drops and then he's just not into it. And then his defense just goes out the window. But oddly enough, it feels like if he makes those first couple, now he's kind of engaged, he's energized, and he's still not a very good defender, but he's still, you know, really active and getting out there. And I think that's should be more of a challenge than it is. But again, Hero's emergence and really being able to handle that backup point guard role, that's been huge, because now you just kind of play him and Dragic and they can both play together too for some minutes. And that's, you know, really something that Miami can go to without worry. But yeah, I was, it was interesting because I was worried about the bench coming into the series. Cause I was like, all right, the Heat have all these guys who you can at least count on. They're at least going to do something. Even if their stats don't blow you away, they're at least going to be really good. But you know, overall, the Boston bench was fine. They did okay against the Heat bench. I think where it got really messy for the Celtics was, again, with Robinson in foul trouble. I think that threw off Miami's normal substitution pattern a little.
Yeah.
And then you ended up with the Heat starters coming back in the first half, going against a lot of Celtics bench. Brad Stevens went to, for a period, he had Grant Williams, Semi Ojeleye, and Brad Wanamaker out there together with, I believe it was with Tatum and Walker. And he usually does not put three bench guys on the floor at the same time. And that was just a mess, because the Heat were able to that was when they really took control of the game in that second quarter and got themselves back in it. And that was the first double digit lead they erased.
All good points. We'll continue breaking down the game one victory with Keith Smith. You're listening to Locked On Heat. Make sure to subscribe to the show on your favorite app to listen to podcasts and always get the latest episodes by asking your smart device to play Locked On Heat when you get in your car to get your team every day. I'm here with Keith Smith. We're talking about the thrilling game one victory for Miami over Boston to start off the Eastern Conference Finals. We'll get into some of your listener questions in our last segment, but I wanted to talk a little bit about a tale of two shooters, at least from my perspective. One, that Duncan Robinson struggled as much as he did, and then two, that Marcus Smart was able to be as effective a shooter as he was. Does this, in your opinion, it seems like that's probably the best performance that you'll get out of Smart, at least on the offensive end. I know he's pretty up and down and somewhat inconsistent at times, but if you get this kind of performance for Smart and you force Robinson to be as bad as he was in game one, how do you feel about Boston's chances in the rest of the series? Because to me, it seems like this was the very worst version of Duncan, and perhaps that's the Heat starting lineup. And if that's the case, I'm not sure how Boston continues to make adjustments moving forward. I mean, I know that's obvious. Maybe that's a little premature, and Gordon Hayward is set to return at some point, and that'll change things somewhat. But considering how good Smart was and how bad Robinson was, I'm not sure what Boston's chances are moving forward. And it's not like I'm being cocky here, but it almost seems, again, that like you got a very bad performance from one of your star players in Robinson. You didn't have like a great shooting night from Jay Crowder, although he did finish with 22 points. And their bench struggled. All of Miami's strengths seem to be mitigated to some extent, and yet Boston still kind of come up with a way to win this game.
Yeah, it's certainly a worry that you know, I think of it as you wasted a great Marcus Smart offensive game. I don't know that this was his, he made some plays defensively. I don't know that it was his absolute best defensive game. Both him and Jaylen Brown several times lost cutters, and I think it's they got caught ball watching. And Brad Stevens talked over and over leading up to the series about how good Miami is as a cutting team. And he even compared them to the Warriors and said they're the best cutting scouting team since Golden State. And that's, you know, that's clearly massive praise for any team. So, and I think that's also spot on. I think they run a lot of stuff that it's really helped because Adebayo and Olynyk, you can really run offense through both of them up top because they're both such gifted passers. So I think Brown and Smart will both be better defensively. And I think that'll show up a little bit more because you're not going to get some of those lost guys. They even lost Dragic a couple times on switches where he went. And that's going to be something I think that Stevens is going to go back and really hammer the team on. What gives me, you know, faith for from the Boston perspective is Kemba Walker shot horribly. He was 6 out of 19. Jason Tatum was only 10 out of 24. They combined to go 5 for 21 from three. I don't think they'll be quite that bad again. I think you'll see them shoot it a little bit better. And they missed a lot of good looks too. These weren't a lot of, they certainly missed some tough ones, but that was a lot of good looks. And you mentioned it, Gordon Hayward's going to get back. I think he's pretty close. I wouldn't be surprised if he plays in game two.
Really?
If not, probably game. Yeah, I think he's really close. They said he went through a really hard small group workout, which was probably, that's usually coach speak for like playing 3-on-3 with the guys who don't play as much. And they said he went really hard. He looked good and he felt good. So my guess is he's probably not that far off, especially considering too, we sit here not even knowing when the games are after game three. Yeah, because they're still trying to figure that out because of ESPN and Monday Night Football and all that stuff. You're going to get him back, and I think that's going to be the big difference. So whatever you lose from Smart production-wise, I think you regain from Hayward. And where Hayward will really help is when Miami goes to that zone, because he is Boston's best player at driving the gaps, either for himself to score or to find shooters. And the Celtics had brought parts in that game where they really struggled against the zone defense. And that was, you know, that was a worry coming in, was Miami's going to play zone because they know, I mean, they do it anyway. And they definitely saw how much the Celtics struggled against Toronto. But, you know, so I think there's definitely things the Celtics can clean up. And I'm not, you know, all that worried about it. I think as some guys come back to earth, some other guys will play a little bit better.
Now, it's interesting you bring up the zone because I had totally forgotten about that key point. But Miami brought it out almost instantly, and it threw off Boston to some degree. And that's the funny part, is that Miami hadn't used it at any point during the playoffs up to this point. I don't think they had used it during the seeding games. They didn't use it during their two previous matchups against Indiana and Milwaukee. And then I guess maybe having reviewed the film and the series against Toronto, maybe they recognized that there was some weakness they could exploit there against the Celtics. But it did seem like it made the Celtics a little bit less comfortable. And I know that you pointed out their shooting numbers. I don't know if it was by design that they allowed those players to get those kind of open looks or not. And that might be a way of getting burnt if you're allowing guys like Walker and Tatum. I think Tatum in particular, they were kind of forcing him a little bit well behind the three-point line. And while he has that kind of range, I think they were kind of willing to acquiesce that shot. They were willing to let him take it when he was 30 feet out or longer or further. And that was a little surprising to me. Did you see anything like that as far as his range? I mean, he seemed like he was trying to take these kind of hero shots that he didn't necessarily need to take.
No, definitely. There was some of that. I'm not as concerned about that one at the very end of regulation. I know there are some people saying like, come on, Tatum taking a 30 footer. And, you know, it wasn't a terrible shot and he barely missed it. You know, and he's not going to be able to put it on the floor and go by Derrick Jones Jr. very easily in that position. That's just not, you know, if there's anything Jones Jr. can do, it's going to be defend Jason Tatum in that spot, right? That's probably the best place for him there. And he was, you know, another guy who had a little bit of a rough stretch, but he made the stop there. So I'm not worried about that one. But I think what Jay Crowder especially did was he was really physical with Tatum, especially right off the catch.
Yeah, getting into his body right away.
Exactly. And there was a couple plays in the first half where you're spot on. He pushed him all the way out by the center circle, you know, and had him starting from way out there. And what I was a little disappointed in is Tatum should be able to put the ball on the floor and go by Jay Crowder at this point in his career, but he just wasn't. He was, you know, he might have even gotten a half a step by him, but then he was pulling up for jump shots and those kind of things. The ones that were more concerning to me, just because now this is a third or fourth game in a row that he's been off, was Kemba Walker. He got a lot of good looks at three-pointers, good looks at pull-up jump shots that just didn't go down. He's not missing them by a lot, but you know, a lot or a little, doesn't matter. He's still missing them. And that's getting concerning because now we're several games in to a slump for him. That's what, again, I'm not overly concerned because I could see in game two, you know, everything Smart did, that's Kemba instead. And Kemba goes for 40 points and, you know, in the, you know, helps the Celtics to a win and even up the series, because I think, you know, we're kind of overdue at this point for Kemba to have a big, massive breakout game because he's just played so poorly overall.
He did get hot later on, and he had that mid-range pull-up jumper going down in the fourth quarter and in overtime. Yeah. So he did finish with 19 points, 6 of 19 overall, 6 assists. So not a great game, but not
the one of nine from three. That's the issue.
Yeah, and a lot of those, as you pointed out, they weren't exactly contested shots. I mean, some of them were, but most of them, from what I recall, they seemed like they were pretty good looks, and he just wasn't able to connect on those. So. What did you think about the battle between Bam Adebayo and Daniel Theis? I think that was one of concern. I wasn't quite sure what Adebayo was going to do defensively, but Miami, again, either going zone or switching pretty heavily. So they had Adebayo starting off on Theis, but then eventually shifting onto guys like Tatum, even Walker for a few stretches there. He was pretty effective in using that length to deter Walker when he's trying to pull up for that shot. But Theis, 35 minutes of play, wound up fouling out. Some of those calls, I know Celtics fans are a little upset about it. But
the
war
on Theis.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I think it's a little ridiculous. There was one call there in particular. I can't recall now which one it was, but it just seemed particularly egregious, and Theis was complaining about it.
I think it was the last one on Dragic.
Yeah, that one. But then there was another call where it was an offensive foul on Crowder. Yeah. Should not have been a foul on Crowder, but that's a whole other story. How do you think Theis handled game one? And I kind of want to gush about Adebayo a little bit because his night tonight was phenomenal.
Yeah, let me start with Theis because we could probably go for an hour or more on Bam Adebayo. But I think Theis played really well. I thought Boston was plus 12 when he was in the game. And when he fouled out, Miami immediately went on an 11-4 run. From that point, that basically finished off the game. So I think that was a huge loss when he went out for the Celtics, because they just need him out there for his presence defensively. On offense, he needs to be a little bit more aggressive with his shot and going into shots on the early catch. But because Bam can switch onto anybody, and the Heat aren't going to worry about it. Yeah. The Heat are, on the flip side of that, you're able to do that because they're not going to worry about Theis isn't going to go post up, you know, Goran Dragic or Tyler Hero or Crowder or even Jimmy Butler. He's not going to post anybody up. And you're not overly worried. Where it kind of maybe could have caught him a couple times was I thought he created some offensive rebounding opportunities because he was switched and Adebayo was out around the arc against a smaller player, and he was able to create some stuff there. He drew a couple fouls that way, and then he also batted a couple balls out that Boston came up with. But that's the trade-off. So I think the Celtics need to find a way for him to get more into some jump shots that he can make. The problem is he's been a poor jump shooter in the entire playoffs so far, and he's been a reluctant one. And if he's going to play like that, then you really have to start to look at, all right, what are other options? That's why I think if Gordon Hayward is able to get back, you're going to see the Celtics go to what they call the best five lineup, which is Walker, Smart, Tatum, Brown, and Hayward, and they'll just live with being small. And they'll deal with whatever that comes with. And that's going to come with Bam, you know, probably beating them up inside. But, you know, the block at the end, just an incredible play, you know, absolutely nuts from him. But what impressed me most was he had 9 assists, and they ran so much offense through him. And I know he's a good passer. I've called him the second best passing big in the league behind Nikola Jokic.
Yeah.
And I truly believe that. And that's where I think the Celtics need to – it's hard because you want to drop off him, because you'd rather, you know, live with him shooting a jumper, but he's not going to shoot jumpers from, you know, any further out than about 15 feet on any kind of regularity. So you need to probably, you know, live with pressuring up on him and at least making the passing window a little bit tighter, because you can't let him pick you apart as the Heat back cut you to death.
Yeah. And this is a phenomenal game from Adebayo. Look, you probably want him to connect on a little bit more than 5 of 12 from the field, but he was still able to get to the line, 8 of 11 overall. For him to be able to knock down those shots, to be able to make the plays that he did, and then phenomenally to block that shot and seal the victory for Miami, that was absolutely game changer. It was the kind of play that I think a lot of people tend to overlook, because then it's a game-winning block at game one of the Eastern Conference Finals. You may overlook it. You may even forget it in the annals of history. But it was a phenomenal play. And it was unbelievable. I mean, look, in post-game, he was told that Magic Johnson called the best defensive play he's ever seen in the playoffs. That's probably a little bit exaggerated on Magic's
That's
part.
That's Magic, right?
But at the same time, it was a hell of a play. And for Adebayo I didn't see him even be able to close out that gap between him and Tatum as quickly as he was, but be able to get the hand up Tatum had the full strength and momentum of going up for that dunk. I thought he was going to be able to flush it through, but if you look at the replay, like Adebayo just had his hand bent at a 90-degree angle and was somehow able to send it back with force. That was as impressive a block as I've seen, actually, in Miami Heat history. And that's having seen Alonzo Mourning during the peak as a defensive player of the year history and career. So I don't know, man. That was a phenomenal play from Adebayo. Great playmaking. His passing continues to improve. You just see his connectivity with his teammates continue to grow throughout the playoffs. And it's just – I've been impressed all year long by everything Bam does, and somehow in the playoffs he manages to take it to another level. And while you hope that his offense comes around to the point where he's able to knock down that long-range shot with some regularity, he still makes so many winning plays that he is absolutely deserving of all the praise he gets. But I wanted to move on, and we'll answer some of your listener questions.
Let me – can I say one thing on the Bam block,
too? Absolutely.
I'd probably say many things. But it immediately reminded me of, and I put this on Twitter – years and years ago, I remember Hakeem Olajuwon talking about blocking shots at the rim.
Yeah.
And he said, and I'm going to paraphrase it a little bit here, but I never worried about getting up real high. I just needed to meet him at the rim. I always thought he has to bring it down to me. I just need to be there on time. And that's exactly what Bam did. Tatum went way up.
Yeah,
but Bam was right where he needed to be. And some of the freeze frame shots of him blocking it, it's funny now because there's a couple people like, it's got to be a goaltend. It can't be a goaltend if the handball's still in the player's hand. Yeah. You know, okay, there's no such thing there. But it really is crazy. I mean, it's like he's putting a lid on the basket and sending it back. And how he doesn't have like a broken wrist is, you know, he must be doing those wrist curls and, you know, getting those things real strong. Just, you know, absolutely unbelievable play, you know, by him. And I, you know, all the credit that he's earned. I know the Athletic were in a piece where a scout said, you know, Adebayo and Tice is a wash. That's just insanity to me. And Tice is better than people think. And what kills me with that is it makes me angry because then I have to talk down Tice and people are like, but he's been good. No, he's been good, but it's not a wash. If Miami doesn't win that matchup significantly, they're not going to win the series. It's pretty simple to me, as I think Boston is either even or has advantages in a lot of other spots, but Miami has to win the Bam Adebayo matchup and they have to win the bench matchup. They win those two things, they're going to win the series. But the Bam one has to be massive, you know, with that. So that's, you know, that's just, you know, that was more than one thing. So I apologize for that. But no, I wanted to close with those couple thoughts because I thought they were really important.
I appreciate that. And again, we'll get into some listener questions in the next segment. You're listening to Locked On Heat. But first, I want to tell you, Keith, I'm not sure if you've ever had a Built Bar, but let me tell you, they're the best tasting protein bar that I've ever had. They sent them to all the members of the Locked On Podcast Network, and they've been so great. And as you well know, I've got a toddler. I've pointed this out a number of times. It's hard to keep up with them and even harder to find the time to make a balanced meal. Sometimes you're just on the go, you want a snack, and that's where I just grab a Built Bar. There's 18 amazing flavors, including 6 new ones like caramel brownie, cookies and cream, cherry barcia, and my favorite apple almond crisp. Excuse me. They're so good. They're healthy. They're 100% covered in chocolate. They're soft and easy to chew. They're great for the health conscious person. If you want to lose or maintain weight while indulging in a delicious treat, Built Bars are for you. Again, low calorie, high protein, high fiber, great for keto diets. And best of all, right now, if you go to builtbar.com and use the promo code LOCKEDON, you'll get $10 off your next order. If you use the promo code LOCKEDON for $10 off at builtbar.com, you won't be disappointed. Reminder that you can always reach me via email at lockedonheat@gmail.com or via Twitter using the hashtag AskLOHeat. I'm here with Keith Smith breaking down the thrilling Game 1 victory over the Boston Celtics. And this first question comes in from Carl. let me tell you, Keith, just so you know, a lot of these questions, obviously, with a Heat bet, but I'm curious to get your perspective on that as well. So Carl asks, what's your suggestions on how to slow down Jason Tatum? Because he seems to have an answer for every Miami defense that we throw at him. So this might be one that you're pretty equipped to answer.
Yeah, I think it's you got to get up into him. You have to pressure up into his body. I think Jay Crowder did a good job with that. Jimmy Butler's clearly capable of that. The one issue you have there is, one is if you're in foul trouble and they're calling it tight, he has the ability to live at the line on those, and you have to make sure that you've got the good protection behind. As we saw on that final play, they got up into Tatum, and then Tatum blew by and got to the bucket, but bam, saved the game. So you've got to have that protection in there behind. I would, and then if you're playing without those types of guys in there, you just got to kind of live with it and hope at that point, you know, that maybe he's going to miss some jump shots or settle for contested ones. But that's the best way to defend him. You got to get up on him and pressure him when he's got the ball out high. Otherwise, he's going to pick you apart and he's going to get into those jump shots where he's really, really comfortable.
Now, I had this discussion with Michael Pina on yesterday's podcast, and I saw a lot of the debate around this matchup regarding Tatum and Jimmy Butler and who the best player in the series is. I'm curious as to your perspective on this.
Yeah, it's so here's how I'll answer it. I think Tatum is the best player. I think Jimmy Butler is the better of the two closers, if that makes sense.
Butler, we saw that tonight, too. I think Butler seems much more capable and comfortable in the moment.
Yeah, I think Jimmy, this whole season, I have felt like he has kind of played possum, maybe is the way to put it, where he just kind of that goes through the motions because he's out there playing hard and doing things. But he's just not going to impose his will on games very early. He's just kind of, you know, let my teammates do things. Like, he let Dragic get going. He lets Hero. He's content to let them run a lot of the stuff they run for Duncan Robinson early. But you know, when it gets down to late in quarters, late in halves, and then especially late in the game, he's going to grab that ball and he's going to get going. And he's going to go make a bunch of plays. And I think that's where it's important. I think Tatum is just, he's going to be there all game long. So if, you know, if, it's weird. It's the kind of thing where if Boston had been able to hold on to those two big leads that they had in the game, I think you would have felt really good about Tatum. But I think if we, you know, and you'd feel good about calling him the best player in the game, but Butler and what he does at the end of games is just so good. So that's how I tend to think about it.
Yeah, that's fair. And look, one of the things that I keep pointing out about Jimmy is that his ability to kind of just gauge and get a feel for what's necessary in the game, to me, has been second to none other than LeBron James. He is good enough, I think, in almost every aspect of the game where he can kind of afford to take a step back and just kind of assess things in his own unique fashion and then kind of turn it on when it's necessary. And he's also been very deferential in a good way to his teammates, not in other players. When they defer to teammates, it's usually because they're a little passive or because they don't feel comfortable stepping up in the moment. That's obviously not who Jimmy is. He just wants to get other players going, and he does a phenomenal job of it, has done so all season. And even in his post-game press conference, kept talking up how good Bam's been, how great Tyler's been, how great Jay and Goran in particular have been. So he's been a really great player to watch up close, and he continues to shine even if he's not putting up huge numbers. And even tonight, still doing all the little things, finished 7 of 14, a really effective 50% from the floor, and 2 of 3 from three-point range, as well as 5 rebounds, 5 assists, 2 steals. Just continues to have a great overall game, even if it's not a gaudy level of production. But this next question comes in from ILJC, who asks, is what Miami did sustainable? And I certainly think it is. Now, they got a very great performance from Crowder as far as his overall shooting numbers are concerned. But again, as I pointed out before, a bad Duncan Robinson night, a bad night from their bench, has been a strength of theirs throughout the bubble. They got a pretty solid game from Tyler Hero and coming up with some big clutch shots. But I mean, I certainly think it is. This is the very best version, perhaps defensively. Like you mentioned, maybe that Smart has another level he can reach defensively. But overall, I'd say that Boston's defense was pretty good. And Miami still found a way to shoot 47% from the field and 45% from three-point range. I mean, that seems like it's pretty sustainable if you're able to take what this defense does and still wind up having a pretty effective game overall. And that's considering the fact that they were struggling for most of the first quarter. Only an 18-point first quarter. They're worse in the Orlando bubble. What do you think, Keith?
Well, and then they were awful in the third quarter. I think that might have been even worse.
Yes, that's right. 16 quarter. Points. Yeah, 16 in the third, 18 points in the first. So.
Yeah, they were pretty terrible in both of those. I certainly think it's sustainable. I think Crowder will come back to earth a little bit, but whatever, he comes sure. back to earth. Duncan Robinson.
He probably, hasn't so far, Keith. Yeah. I mean, I
know been... he hasn't. Yeah. It's coming though. It's. I watched Jay Crowder for a long time with the Celtics. I wish I could remember somebody tweeted today if the Celtics hadn't turned Jay Crowder into such a good shooter, he wouldn't be hitting these shots against them in the Eastern Conference Finals, which is funny. You know, just how that worked out. But it's gonna come at some point. He's gonna have one of these 1-for-10 games. It's just the law of averages tells me he's not Steph Curry. But whatever he does, expect Robinson's gonna pick it up, and he'll be better there. And then that's how you kind of even that out. I think this series is what we expect it to be. I think it's going to be a bunch of close games, and it's going to come down to who makes more plays at the end. The only thing I will say is it has a little bit of the same feel to the games Boston lost against Toronto, where the Celtics, when they were playing kind of their game, they were in control and looked great. And then when they let go of the rope, they let go of it. They don't just let go of it. They take it and they throw that thing completely off the cliff. And that's it. And then the Heat are, off and running, and the Heat looked like the best team in the league. And I think that's what worries you a little bit there is I think Miami – because of their versatility of their scoring attack, they can find offense easier than Toronto can. So if the Celtics get them down, they've got to stay with it. They cannot, let go of the rope, because they would do that against Toronto. And it didn't really cost them in their wins, but in their losses, it was right there. So I think we're going to get a bunch of close games. I think if there's any blowouts, I think Boston is more likely to blow out Miami, because I think we saw how that could happen, there. But I don't think that's very likely. I mean, if we get even one blowout in this series, I'd be kind of surprised. I think it's going to be a whole bunch of close games that are really tight the whole way.
All right. I've got two last questions from Steven, friend of the program. His first question is, how terrible was that foul call on Derrick Jones Jr. on a dead ball to tie the game? And again, if you haven't seen the play call, it looks pretty egregious. Derrick Jones Jr. inserted for a defensive play at the end of regulation when Miami is up one. And then it looks like he's pushed by Kemba Walker into Marcus Smart, and it doesn't take much contact for Smart to fall to the ground. I know Smart is beloved by Celtics fans. I could totally understand why he is, but that looked like an obvious flop. Not only that, but probably an offensive foul on Walker for shoving Derrick Jones Jr., who weighs about $1.50 when he's soaking wet. What was your take on that? Because to me, it was an absolutely terrible call, but I understand why it was made too.
Yeah, that's my take as well. Is I would prefer that they don't. Unfortunately, all season long, they've been making that call late in games. Boston lost two games that way in the regular season, which now, we did have one of those back in, the olden days. There was a regular season, and they lost two games like that this year off-ball plays where they fouled guys. And it's starting to become something that they're calling more consistently. I wish they wouldn't.
Is Brad capable of calling that? Like, is he capable of designing that play?
No, that was just designed to be a screen. It was, I think it was designed for Smart to screen. I don't think he was trying to screen for Kemba there. I think he was trying to screen for Brown. It looked like Brown was curling around the top, and Kemba was backing back out. So I think Kemba came in, did there, I'm going to push off and I'm going to back out and open up that way while Brown curls around the screen. But yeah, it's one of those where we know if Marcus Smart feels even the slightest brush of contact in that situation, he's going to go down. Yeah. And sometimes that helps the Celtics, and there's a lot of times it hurts them on both ends of the floor. There's times when he flops himself right out of a play and the other team scores, and it's, it is what it is. So yeah, I'm with you. I don't like that call there, but I'm also not surprised at all that they made it.
All right. And our last question, also from Steven, he asks, Hero almost had a triple double again, one assist shy. Has his play during these playoffs made him have the best rookie playoff performance for a Heat player? Well, I think that's actually a lot easier of a question than you expect, because obviously Miami, not a team that drafts very well. And so it's not like you have a huge sample size to choose from. There are not a lot of rookies that have a high impact in the playoffs, with the exception of one guy who was drafted back in 2003 out of Marquette University. That guy turned out to be a pretty solid pick for the Heat, and obviously had a game winner against the Charlotte Hornets in the opening round of the playoffs that year. pretty solid overall, but I think, honestly, given the circumstances of the Orlando bubble and the challenges and the fact that they faced some pretty tough opponents in Milwaukee and now against Boston, that he continues to embrace the moment and perform at a high level, I'd absolutely have to say that he has been the best rookie playoff performer in Heat franchise history. And again, maybe that's not a lot to choose from. You can probably go back to Mario Chalmers and Michael Beasley in 2008. And other than that, off the top of my head, I can't really think of any other impact. Maybe Norris Cole during the Big Three era might have had a big game coming off the bench, but not to the same position that Hero is, where he's expected to create plays, he's expected to inject some life into a listless offense, and he's done so throughout the course of the playoffs and over the regular season. We saw him hit game winners. We've seen him hit big shots. He just embraces that moment in a way that even your typical veteran does not like to do, and he just seems to thrive. He just takes his game to another level where he knocks down that shot. And even when Jimmy Butler, who is a great clutch player, or Goran Dragic, who has stepped up in key moments, seem reluctant to take the shot, it doesn't matter to Tyler Hero. He pulls up for a big three, and it's just like a regular play.
Yeah, I'm throwing cold water all over that just because Dwayne Wade was awesome as a rookie in the playoffs. 18 points per game, you know, 5 assists. He only really had one bad game in that entire playoff run. He had a 2-point stinker against New Orleans. I'm looking at his game log. I do not remember this off the top of my head. Just in case anybody was wondering.
I knew
he was good, though. I did remember he was really good. I mean, he was great. A bunch of 20-point games in there. Tennis, twice he had double-doubles with 10 assists in there. So, this is tough because now it sounds like I'm talking down Tyler Hero.
No, it's fine. Recency bias completely on my part.
Yeah, it's just Dwayne Wade was so good in that first playoff run. You know, won a series, you know, not by himself, but that team wasn't very good that year. I remember that. So this is just kind of a fun aside. I loved Dwayne Wade when he was at Marquette because his Marquette team beat Holy Cross.
Okay.
Which is a New England school in the NCAA tournament. That's when I fell in love with Dwayne Wade. So I was a huge Dwayne Wade guy his whole rookie year. And I remember when they went into the playoffs and they were playing the Hornets in the first round. I remember being like, they're going to win, you know, and Dwayne Wade's really good. And all these people were like, he's a rookie. He's not going to do anything, you know. And, you know, I wish there had been Twitter then so I could be like, see, I look at all these old tweets I had, you know, because we all know I would have tweeted it a lot. Absolutely. That's the only thing. I gotta stick up for my guy D Wade there. You know, he was so good in that first playoff run. But you know, if you're second in Miami Heat history to Dwayne Wade in anything, that's a pretty damn good place to be.
That's fair, and I'm glad that you brought that up. And that's probably a pretty good place to wrap it up. So Keith, again, thank you so much for taking the time to join me in the podcast. Maybe we'll talk more depending on how long the series goes. As always, make sure to follow Keith for lots of great insight, great writing on everything NBA related. You can do so by following him on Twitter at KeithSmithNBA. Make sure you do that because you will not be disappointed. Be sure to subscribe and follow this podcast to get the latest episode of Locked On Heat as soon as it's out. I'm David Ramil signing off and thanking you, as always, for your support.